Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, June 19th, also known as Juneteenth, celebrating the end of slavery at the end of the Civil War in the United States. Today we have some interesting features for you today. We're going to be starting off with an update, an interview on the current TSSU negotiations with SFU, one of the big issues facing Simon Fraser University and its community right now. We have TSSU shop steward Felix Ruiz de la Orden with me here. Hello.
Hi. Well, thanks for having me.
Great. And we're also going to be have a feature on Japanese artist Yao Sobi from our guest host, Ayu, and Peter is here as well. We're going to start the show off, though, with the TSSU. Welcome to the program, Felix.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, the TSSU has been in contract negotiations with SFU actually for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And a couple months ago, the TSSU membership voted overwhelmingly to authorize strike action on the against the university. And the negotiations carried on. But in the last week and a half or so, a lot has happened. And a week ago on Friday, you actually took strike action or gave the university notification, 72 hours notification of strike action. What led to that decision?
So after the – we had an initial strike vote and SFU challenged that strike vote on the basis that research assistants could not legally go on strike.
Right. So this is the one that happened a couple months ago where you got 94% support.
Yeah, we got 94% support. We argued that that went against kind of our charter rights as workers to be able to go on strike. But it looked like it would have been a prolonged legal battle for anywhere up to like 6 months or something like that. So we said, you know, this is not really where our power lies. Our power lies in relationships and our organizing capacity. We decided to go to withdraw our strike vote, have expedited bargaining for, I believe it was 3 weeks, and see what happened at the end of that. So that bargaining, just the power of that strike vote alone actually got quite a bit done at the bargaining table. However, we were still at an impasse on many key issues, including getting a cost of living and stuff like increased compensation for more students. When we were still at an impasse after those 3 weeks, we decided to hold a second strike vote, this time with just the teaching support staff. We received 91% mandate to go on strike. And that's where we ended up. We ended up serving strike notice at convocation. Mm-hmm. And now we're here.
So tell me a bit more about serving strike notice at convocation.
The timelines ended up just working out that way. We had a member who wanted to do it. We decided to go there. We didn't want to disrupt everyone else's big day, obviously. What we did, we had a member who is graduating serve strike notice to President Troy Johnson. We dropped a banner We did a little cheer, and that was about the end of it.
Yeah. So this was like right up on the stage.
Yeah, yeah.
During one of the ceremonies, and as you say, a fairly sort of brief incident, but captured on, I don't know about video, but I saw a photograph of it of the actual handover of the strike notice.
And I mean, so we've been kind of. The senior administration has essentially toyed with us for so long. If we want to get anything done in bargaining, it seems like we have to put an incredible amount of pressure. So we were fed up. We know that one of the things that gets to these folks is if you kind of embarrass them.
Right.
That's what we tried to do and make a big show of it. And it helped with our organizing too, right? So we were able to talk to people that day and let people know what was going on as well.
Right. So a lot of stuff has happened in the last week since then. That was on Friday a week ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot has happened since then. What was the first steps the TSSU took in terms of making that strike action, the action you were taking?
Yeah, so I mean, 72 hours after serving strike notice, we implemented our first job actions, which were pretty low key. I mean, it's just something to get going and to kind of build up that capacity and that we want. So we started with an overtime ban teach-ins. So teach-ins are essentially we ask that all the teaching staff before their tutorials or their classes start spend anywhere from 5 to 10 minutes just talking to their students about what's going on. The idea of that is, we see our students as part of our community as well. We want to keep them in the loop, and it's one way to kind of engage and interact with them. So it was pretty low key, and the university responded by taking away all our members' health care.
Right.
So that includes our extended health plan as well as the paid MSP for international students. We saw this as quite a big escalation.
Mm-hmm.
It happened back in 2015 during the strike then. As senior administration threatened to take away our health care. But this was after around 6 months of prolonged job action as well.
Right.
Yeah. And back then there was, a lot of negative attention from the community as well, because it just seems like an egregious, like a really awful escalation to just go and take away. And this came right after the vice president, people, equity, inclusion, also. So the day before, sent out an email saying, if the strike is weighing on you mentally, access our mental health supports, yada, yada, yada. So on the one hand, they claim to care about mental health and the well-being of their community members, and the next day they take away our health care.
Right. And at this point, when they took away your health care, your job action was no overtime and the teach-ins at that point. So
yeah.
You hadn't withdrawn services.
No, not at all.
Okay.
And so we decided that... because of this escalation, we needed to respond. I guess it was 2 days later or a day later on Thursday, we decided to picket the Task 2 building in the Shrum Science Centers.
Right. So we asked, CGSF asked the university about making someone available for an interview as well. And they haven't done that, but they have been releasing statements throughout the week through their website.
Yeah.
And in their statement online, they have one specifically about the withdrawal of member benefits, which they say, well, it says here, to be clear, the university has not removed or suspended any benefits from TSSU members. In a strike situation, wages and benefits are typically suspended during periods when employees are on strike and not reporting to work, which is not what was happening at the time that they did this withdrawal. So yeah. They're being a little disingenuous, it seems. Obviously that did not go over well with your members.
No, not at all. I mean, everyone was extremely upset. We spent a team of us, of organizers, ended up going around and talking to people. It seems that benefits would not be withdrawn until July 1st, but we're still in talks with the university to figure out the logistics of that. It is on their part. It is lawful. They have the right to do that, but it's almost never done in these types of labor disputes because it's seen as quite a huge escalation. And President Troy Johnson had been lying about it to people too. Anyone who'd asked her said that it was all TSSU lies. And I guess after they released that statement, they finally accepted that they did in fact threaten to take away our benefits. And now it turns out Troy Johnson's on vacation, so I guess the heat was too much for her.
So what's happening now? Are you still picketing?
So as of right now, we are not picketing.
Yeah.
We have to kind of come together as the strike committee and figure out the next steps here. Last week, we wanted to respond to taking away the health care. And things are moving pretty quick. We'll be talking throughout this week and figuring out our next steps here.
And are you still are talks going on with the university this week?
As far as I know, no. They wanted us to come back to the bargaining table, but we did that last week or 2 weeks ago. Two weeks ago now. They called us back to the bargaining table. And we decided to go back, and they offered us a 0.1 wage increase on their previous one. So we saw it was a complete waste of time still came nowhere close to a living wage. And we decided, you know what, unless you're serious about bringing forward proposals that we can actually talk about, we don't want to waste our time talking to them.
Right. So specifically, just remind us of what the issues are in this negotiation and what the TSSU is asking for.
So we're asking for a living wage, job security, and pay tied to the size of a class, right? So and removing equivalencies. So there's a couple of things in how tutorials and classes are structured, where in some departments the same length tutorial is actually paid less than the same length tutorial in another department, and we're trying to find equity across all departments. And especially since the pandemic, we've seen increased class sizes as well. We want pay tied to the number of students in those classes. So more pay for more work, job security, and a living wage.
Right. So in one of its other statements that are posted online, SFU has stated that in response to the TSSU's request and proposals, that it says here, SFU's bargaining team tabled the maximum allowable monetary package under the province's shared recovery mandate. So what they're saying here is they've offered everything as much as they can, and that's it. What's the TSSU's position in response to that?
That's the position they like to take because, you know, they like to make that maximum. We know that they have more money. stashed away that they could give us. They also take into account, so the way that they kind of discuss monetary issues too, is that, you know, if you get any sort of extra benefit or anything, that gets included in that monetary. And we're saying that, you know, we should be able to have stuff like increased compensation for higher class sizes without that getting taken out of, say, the main wage that we're right. getting.
So where do you see this? I mean, I'm not asking, where do you see this going from here? Do you feel like this is going to drag on for a while, or do you, hard to tell?
I mean, I hope it's done quickly, because, you know, we're not here as young academics, to be on strike. We want to be teaching. Most of us really love teaching. Most of us love doing research. We'd rather be doing that. So I'm hoping that it doesn't last long, but we'll be out here as long as it takes. And just looking historically at this administration, we do need to put pressure on them to be able to, you know, get anything done. And avoid having some of our most basic rights, like job security, for example, taken away.
Right. So going forward, what can students expect to see?
So I guess students can expect probably more job actions. We do want to work on our, you know, student outreach, especially to undergraduates. We do want them on our side. And so you can also expect probably, you know, a discussion or an organizer coming and talking to you about what's going on.
Right. So in a bit of the issue around the strike vote, SFU wanted to see research assistants not included in that vote?
Yeah.
I know that out at UBC just this spring, last month, research assistants specifically just got authorized to be unionized. Mm-hmm. And they're already included in your union, right, as part of your representation?
Yeah.
Is that part of an issue going forward? Because it sounds to me, and I want to say I don't know exactly the legalese of all this stuff, you know, what I read about the SFU research assistants is that they're not really employees, but they're sort of in a gray area.
Yeah.
Of, you know, they get money from the university, but they're not necessarily in an ordinary employment situation. I mean, given that you guys represent the research assistants already,
yeah,
and research assistants out at UBC obviously felt the need for protection under a union umbrella. What is the TSSU's position around that?
So,
and maybe a question is, you know, should that status of research assistants maybe be transformed into something more like an employment situation than what is happening now?
Yeah, I mean, our position is that all research assistants are absolutely employees. The universe. So when we unionized research assistants back in 2019,
yeah,
we signed over 1,000 union cards. It was clear that research assistants wanted to be part of the TSSU. SFU signed what's called a voluntary recognition agreement, essentially agreeing that research assistants were part of the university. That voluntary recognition agreement said all research assistants and grant employees. So they went back on that agreement and then decided, hey, about half of those research assistants are actually getting paid through scholarship, and they're in a student relationship and not an employment relationship. A lot of these research assistants are producing a tremendous amount of value for the university. A lot of them work in labs that are funded by industry partners. So they're making a lot of money for private companies. They do stuff that contributes to their thesis, but they also do things that contribute to to the lab itself and to the principal investigator as well as the university. And so right now, we want to bring research. We want to fight SFU on this. And the best way we can do that is to sign union cards once again, because the law has changed. And if we get 55% of research assistants to sign union cards, right, they automatically become certified bargaining unit members, right, and SFU, and that will fall under the jurisdiction of the labor board, and will finally come to a determination. So if you're a research assistant, you should come by the TSSU office and sign a union card.
Okay. One other thing to raise just before we finish up here, because in SFU statement posted online on Saturday, they make mention of received reports from members of the university community concerned about certain behaviors at picket lines. And then they go on to say that harassment and intimidation is never acceptable at SFU, and the university is addressing reports of inappropriate behavior at the picket lines. So what's your response to that, and do you know what they're talking about?
So it was clear to me that this is obviously was their plan should pickets come, is to stir up a lot of confusion. So their initial communications encouraged people to cross the picket line. There were professors who held classes and told their students that they had to cross the picket line. Picket lines are not, they are a political act. They're causing kind of, they're a real kind of material act as well. Mm-hmm. When our members were talking to people trying to cross the picket line, they started sending out emails saying, you know, report any quote unquote intimidation and coercion. We think that's, their way of trying to invalidate us, and we reject that.
Right. All right. Well, I guess just a quick recap. So you're not currently picketing?
No, not at the moment.
there aren't talks ongoing right now,
yeah,
at this moment with the university. And what job action are you currently taking?
So the overtime ban is still in effect, and we will be continuing with the teach-ins as well,
right,
as we determine the next steps. But like I said earlier, things are moving fast. So keep an eye, like if you're a TSSU member, SFU community member, keep an eye out on communications.
Right.
We'll be communicating, any next steps.
All right. And where can your own members, TSSU members, but also other members of the university community and students find out more about TSSU positions?
Yeah, so you could go to bargaining.tssu.ca,
yeah,
or our main website, tssu.ca.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. And the university statements are also online. They're very easy to find by just Googling SFU statement on TSSU, and they come up as the first results. I won't give you complicated URLs for that. If you want to learn more about what's happening with the strike and how it may or may not affect you, it's easy to find out. And we'll be having Felix here back on the radio probably soon when once there are further developments or hopefully perhaps a resolution before long.
Yeah.
Felix Ruiz de la Orden is Chief Steward of the Teaching Staff Support Union at SFU or the TSSU. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
And good luck with the current negotiations, and let's all hope for a fast resolution, because that's everybody wins with that.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care.
You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We'll be back in a couple minutes with an artist profile with Ayu, who's going to bring us an artist profile of the Japanese performer Yao Sabi. No, Yosabi. Yeah. We'll get the proper pronunciation from her. I'm doing my best here. First, though, this is a bird note.
This is Bird Note.
Thanks, Felix.
The modern chicken, a descendant of the red jungle fowl, was domesticated thousands of years ago. But chickens haven't always just been farm animals. During the Iron Age, the rooster's morning call became a symbol for chickens' divine connection to the sun. In the city of Babylon, which is in modern-day Iraq, historical illustrations show priests worshipping chickens set upon pedestals. In the Zoroastrian religion and in Greek mythology, chickens were considered sacred, responsible for bringing light to the world. When chickens made their way to Europe, they were considered exotic and even holy. Julius Caesar wrote that the Britons consider it contrary to divine law to eat the hare, the chicken, or the goose. Archaeologists even found some of the first chickens in Europe buried alongside people. In the Roman Empire, chickens were farmed and eaten, but when the population fell around BCE 400, they regained their divine status. In the 9th century, Pope Nicholas I ordered that rooster figures be placed atop church steeples in honor of the many biblical references to the species. Today, the chicken's sacred status lives on in artwork, in holiday traditions, and in our admiration for these common but fascinating creatures. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Eves Jarvis and a track called At the Whims. That's from his album The Zug, which came out almost a year ago in last summer. And he's a Canadian artist. All right, joining me is Ayu Sakamoto.
Hi.
Thanks for being part of the show. And we're going to do another artist profile of a Japanese artist perhaps you've never heard of. Ayu, you are from Japan yourself.
Yes.
How long have you been here in Canada?
So I've been here for about 9 months.
9 months?
Yes.
And you're studying here to go to school, right?
Yes.
At Douglas College?
Yeah, Douglas College.
Yeah, what are you studying?
So I'm currently studying marketing and business and communication because I'm in general studies.
Yeah.
So, but until last semester, I'm taking only English courses, and I finished my English course, so that's why.
Good. And then you're going to get into your regular studies pretty soon.
Yeah.
Excellent. And what part of Japan are you from? Where?
So my hometown is near Tokyo, and it's called Yokohama, city called Yokohama.
Yeah. It's a big city on its own, right?
It's a very big city.
I've heard of Yokohama.
Oh, nice.
So tell me a bit about this artist you're going to introduce us to.
Okay, today I'd like to introduce you to a Japanese artist called Yoasobi, and it's a Japanese music duo that has been making waves in the music industry since their debut in 2019. And the first song I'll be sharing with you is called Yoru ni Kakeru, which is released in 2019.
Okay, I just want to make sure I'm going to play the right one. This is the one whose English title is Racing into the Night?
Oh, yes.
Yes? Okay. Good. It does come with a content warning about dealing with difficult topics of suicide. I imagine it's in Japanese. But nevertheless, people should know that it does come with that warning. All right, so we're going to play this song. Can you introduce it again?
The introducing?
Yeah, what's the song again? Yeah.
This song is called Yoru ni Kakeru, and it's released in 2019.
Okay.
Sayonara, Kakeru. する君は綺麗だ明けない夜にこぼれた涙も君の笑顔に溶けてくわ変わらない日々に泣いていた僕を君は優しく終わりへと誘う沈むように溶けてゆくように染みついた霧が晴れる忘れてしまいたくて閉じ込めた日々に差し伸べてくれた君の手を取る涼しい風が空を泳ぐように今吹き抜けてゆく繋いだ手を離さないでよ二人今夜に駆け出してく
There we are.
Yes.
What was that we just listened to?
Oh, sorry. What did you say?
Tell us what that track was we just listened to.
Oh, so that was Yoru ni Kakeru by Yoasobi.
All right. And the according to YouTube, the English translation of the title is Racing into the Night.
Yes.
Just for people who are intrigued, maybe you can spell out the name just so... The band's name, the artist's name, just so people can find it easily if they're looking for it.
Yeah, Yoasobi is Yoasobi. And so can I talk about...
Yeah, tell us more about the band.
Okay. So Yoasobi consists of vocalist Ikura and composer Ayase, and their music is a unique blend of electronic pop and J-pop, creating a sound that's both captivating and distinctive. And their music is known for its catchy melodies, intricate production, and poetic lyrics. And the song we just listened, Yoru ni Kakeru, is Yoasobi's debut single, and it's released in 2019 and quickly became a hit in Japan and around the world. The song's music video has over 200 million views on YouTube, and the song has top chart in Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. And one of the reasons why Yoasobi's music has become so popular is the way they incorporate traditional Japanese elements into their music. For example, the song Haruka features a koto, which is traditional Japanese stringed instrument, and the song Gunjo features a Japanese flute called shakuhachi. Another reason why Yoasobi's music has resonated with so many people is the relatable nature of their lyrics. Their song often deal with theme of love, loss, and self-discovery, and their lyrics are known for their poetic beauty and emotional depth. Yoasobi is a talented and innovative music duo that has captured the hearts of millions of fans around the world. Their unique sound, poetic lyrics, and incorporation of traditional Japanese elements make them stand out in the crowded music industry. If you haven't already, I highly recommend checking out their music. Just a couple of months ago, Yoasobi released a song called Idol. It's opening theme song for the TV anime, Oshinoko. The song has surpassed 200 million cumulative streams on the Billboard Japan chart and become the fastest song to reach 100 million streams. On June 10th, the song became the first Japanese song to reach number one on the Billboard Global excluding US chart. This song is about the double life of a star in the Japanese idol industry. Yoasobi released with both a Japanese and English version, so you can check the meaning of the lyrics by listening to the English version. But what we'll listen from now is the original version of the song. Please listen with attention to the pop sound and changes in melody. Here's Idol by Yoasobi.
その秘密ミステリアス抜けてるとこさえ彼女のエリア完璧で嘘つきな君は天才的な愛と様今日何食べた好きな本は遊びに行くならどこに行くの何も食べてないそれは内緒何を聞かれてものらりくらりそう淡々とだけどさんさんと味噌で見えない花からおまけですお星様の引き立て役 B です全てがあの子のおかげなわけないしょらくさい妬み嫉妬なんてないわけがないこれはネタじゃないからこそ許せない完璧じゃない君じゃ許せない自分も許せない誰よりも強い君以外は認めない誰も信じ諦めてるまさに最強で無敵の愛と弱点なんて見当たらない一番ポシポやっと知ってる秘密だけは愛してるって嘘で積むキャリアこれこそ私なりの愛だ流れる汗も綺麗なアクアルビーを隠したこのマグダ歌い踊り舞う私はマリアそう嘘はとびきりの愛だ誰かに愛されたことも誰かのことを愛したこともないそんな私の嘘がいつか本当になること信じてるいつかきっと全部手に入れる私はそう欲張りな愛だと信じたいねみんなのことちゃんと愛したいから今日も嘘はつくのこの言葉がいつか本当になる日を願ったそれでもまた君と君にだけは言えずにいたけど
IDOL by YOASOBI. I'm very glad to share one of my favorite Japanese music duo YOASOBI with you today. And you can listen to their music on Spotify, Apple Music, and other music streams. But I personally recommend that you enjoy them on YouTube because their music videos are animated and it's so fun to watch.That's all from me. Thank you.
Yeah, it's quite a good video, obviously drawing a lot from the anime program it's associated with, because you were mentioning when you were talking earlier that it is the title song for a very popular Japanese anime program.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, so YOASOBI. Find them on YouTube. And who knows, with 200 million streams... and even, I think this one, where were we now? It's got, well, this track, you know, has the YouTube one we're looking at here has almost 90,000 comments, not just streams. People have gone, you know, gone to the site and actually felt the need to add their thoughts about it. And you were mentioning that they, with this track, there's also an English version. So perhaps they're seeing about breaking into the North American and European music scenes, already very big in Asia, as you mentioned, in Japan and Korea and Taiwan. Yeah. And who knows, maybe we'll be seeing them here. Very catchy stuff.
Yes.
Thanks for bringing that to us, Ayu.
Thank you.
Ayu Sakamoto bringing us that. Introduction to some up-and-coming Japanese music. Well, up-and-coming here, pretty well-established in Japan. All right, now we have, let's move on to some more parts of our program. This is Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Sometimes the rivers, lakes, and oceans we love to swim in contain contaminants that can make us sick. When rain falls hard and fast, it can rush across the land surface, picking up anything in its path.
That can include dirt, that can include bacteria, viruses, that can include chemicals, things like oil and grease.
Rachel Noble is a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She says those pollutants and contaminants can end up in waterways, and so can raw sewage. That's because in some communities, sewage and stormwater run through the same pipes to a treatment facility. Extreme rain can overwhelm these systems.
And that means that pathogens or dangerous chemicals that might have been removed during the wastewater treatment process are not getting treated.
Public swimming spots are monitored for dangerous pathogens and closed when there's a threat to public health. But it can take up to a day to get the results. So Noble's team created a rapid test that can deliver results in about 2 hours. And she hopes that as more states adopt the new technology, fewer people will get sick from contaminated water. So all they take home from swimming are memories.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Thank you. You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Magnus Tewald. I'm your host for this hour. And thanks to Ayu Sakamoto for that great introduction to the band Yesobi. Joining me now is Peter.
Hello there, Magnus. Okay.
How are you doing this week?
Oh, okay.
So tell me, what's been bugging you about the world this week?
Oh,
big question, eh?
Well, I'd like to update something that was done very briefly 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So I said I was going to try to arrange to interview Alan Sins. He teaches political science over at not Simon Fraser, but
UBC.
UBC, yeah. but the competition. And I actually went in person 2 weeks ago after I had said it, and he seemed okay, fine, sent an email. And then I sort of sent a background, because I had audited. Auditing is that I'm a non-auditor, by the way. A non-auditor, it doesn't take any classes, but he may be in a class.
Right, you sort of sit in on classes, but you're not necessarily.
The concept of auditing is actually that you are taking some class and you're trying to figure out if you want the next one for the next semester. But this was non-auditing. And Alan Sins didn't find that amusing on that 2 weeks ago Monday anyway. But he didn't seem too off about having an interview, but I sent an email, a second one, just to establish that we had contact, you know. And I said, oh, you didn't really critical the rollback, the IMF, the Institute seems to have gotten years ago, a mainland Chinese media conglomerate had given it some funding. And then he sent it back, says, no, I don't want an interview. But he went a bit further. He said, don't come to the office and don't come to my classes anymore. That's what he told me. And so I was sort of curious, like, oh, really? But I was a bit curious about what the UBC policy, it happened at UBC, so I didn't go to SFU, but what their policy is about auditing. And at the admissions, they said, well, it's the actual fire, what the regulations are for fire. Because there were a very, well, we don't like that happening. We don't like that. But
so they don't like people auditing or
unofficially? No, auditing is not really. And I have something else I'm going to bring up about auditing, Magnus.
Yeah.
But in general, it's not liked in general. You got to really, that teacher must really like you, especially if you're a non-auditor, auditor for you to sit in that class. Usually it's not seen as something. But then I asked at I was directed over to the for people signing up admissions, mm-hmm. and I said, well, what is the legality? Like, what's the law? There's a lot of things we don't like, but there's no law against it or whatever. And at the end, they said, well, the fire laws are basically it. Like, you can't have too many people coming in.
Right.
But I don't know where that's going to happen with Alan. If I'm one day, he does. I mean, he has to have total attendance mm-hmm. for me to break the fire regulations. But actually, I did it once. I don't. It's sort of a symbolic task for me to go through his course again, actually, because I wanted to know exactly the entire class.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't there. Oh, well, I don't know exactly what he felt about something because I wasn't there that day. So I did do the entire class. It would be a symbolic thing to go through it again, but I would be up to it as such. But the other thing was that at that time, I basically accidentally was there the first day, and I knew where it was. Right. And I knew the other day, so that was sort of an accident.
Right.
What's interesting, now here's a guy, I'm a bit hypocritical maybe to bring this up, because there's a guy I don't like, like that much, Abby Hoffman. Now, Abby Hoffman did a...
You see the yippie from years back, that fellow?
Yes.
Yeah.
Magnus, you have forgotten already. He used to be really big.
Oh, I remember, not personally, a little before my time, but, he was one of the big deals in 60s activism.
Yeah. No, I know. The thing is that he sort of, he killed himself in 89. He killed himself in 1989.
Yeah.
But he was still... out there, and he did a 1971 book called Steal This Book, which is a bit counterproductive because if he wants the book out at bookstores and people are stealing it, but I don't know. We all kind of that's what he chose to do, which yeah. I think is a bit too much. But he actually has a chapter in that book that is saying that you ought to audit courses.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as I say, there's a lot of things I don't particularly care for them. But I would say if any teacher is really big on Abby Hoffman and they're saying we don't like auditors, or he's actually saying for non-auditor auditors, because he says, oh, don't even enroll, just drop in the classes. He has this rather elaborate thing how to do it. Like you can even get the text, find out where the textbooks are. And so there's something... I think he's very intense. Abby Hoffman was very intense.
Yeah,
and I think he is in his other views he was intense. Actually, I got it. I knew that he had done it, and there was a copy at the library here at the SFU library, which is the best of Abby Hoffman or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it has a foreword by Norman Mailer, so it has steal this book. And a few other ones. And one thing, the short Norman Mailer in introduction was saying that he didn't want to. Actually, it was done right after he killed himself, but he had plans to bring out the best of Abby Hoffman before mm-hmm. he killed himself. And one thing that Norman Mailer was saying to him, do you want to change to the drug, what you said about drugs? And I myself have never taken these things, but Abby Hoffman had. And he said, well, in what we know about crack cocaine and all this. And Abby Hoffman said, no, I'm going to leave the statements as they are, because mm-hmm. I made them in a certain context, and I still agree with a lot of it. But so that's an example where I don't quite agree with him.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I don't going forth on this. I hoping to maybe have some interviews with other people in both UBC and Simon Fraser in political science. And there's a specific program now, which is sort of taken over. But the Malou Institute has sort of taken over political science over at UBC. And it's kind of a specific outlook. One thing that's been going on is this mainland Chinese. I feel the elections, they've been intruding. But for 30 years, ever since the end of the Cold War, the high elites have said we're going to economically sort of collaborate with mainland China. And I think right now, for the first time actually in a while, maybe because of COVID, but they have never told us what exactly happened. I mean, we've asked them questions. Can we inspect the labs? No. Well, we don't really want that. Now, interesting, Bill Gates went to mainland China a few days ago, and I don't think he asked them any questions, but he was telling us what to do. He was telling third world countries, you can't make your own vaccines. So, I mean, he was sort of big on the COVID issue.
Yeah. So, yeah. Interesting stuff.
Okay, Magnus, have you got a song to
send
you off here?
Just about. So you're going to be hoping to talk to some profs, academics, about some of these issues.
Yes.
China, the World Bank,
the World Bank, IMF is one thing.
All right.
Other things as well.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to those.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to 2.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.
All right, we're just about at the end of our program. You've been listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We started at the top of the hour with a big update on the TSSU-SFU negotiations and strike, and lots has been happening in the last week. So thanks to Felix Della Orden, Chief Steward for the TSSU, for joining us on the program. Ayu gave us a great intro to Japanese band Yosobi. She's giggling at my poor pronunciation over there. A nice chat with Peter. And Peter's going to bring us some stuff, hopefully, in some coming weeks on international relations. Let's do a quick look at the weather today for this week. It's pretty rainy out there today. It's probably good for the fire situation in the province. Highs up to 15, down to lows overnight of 11. Very similar tomorrow. Clouds and rain with a chance of showers, 60%. Things start improving on Wednesday, with the temperature getting up to the 20s. And then Thursday through the weekend is looking pretty good with temperatures in the low 20s and sun on Thursday, Friday, and a mix of sun and cloud on the weekend. So some nice weather to look forward to. Thanks for tuning in. Democracy Now! Is coming up next in just a few moments. Up at noon is Wandering Rhythm with Nick Legacy. And at 3 o'clock, it's Typically Tuesday with Leslie Wang. All that more coming up here on CGSF 90.1 FM, your campus community radio station from Burnaby, BC.